Now, I read immediately the passage in Habakkuk chapter 1 that we'll be looking at together this evening. Now, we've looked at Habakkuk's complaint in verses 1 to 4, the first chapter, and the Lord's answer to Habakkuk. So now we come to verse 12, and we're reading there into chapter 2 into verse 1. Habakkuk chapter 1, verse 12. O Lord, are you not from everlasting? My God, my Holy One, we will not die. O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have ordained them to punish. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous? Why are you silent while the wicked swallow up those more righteous than themselves? You have made men like fish in the sea, like sea creatures that have no ruler. The wicked foe pulls all of them up with hooks. He catches them in his net. He gathers them up in his dragnet, and so he rejoices and is glad. Therefore he sacrifices to his net and burns incense to his dragnet. For by his net he lives in luxury and enjoys the choicest food. Is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? I will stand at my watch and station myself on the ramparts. I will look to see what he will say to me and what answer I am to give to this complaint. May the Lord be pleased then to bless that portion of his word. Now, we've already considered in these opening verses of Habakkuk chapter 1 the first complaint or the first plea of Habakkuk. He remember he had two main questions, didn't he? He wanted to know how long it would be before God would intervene and why God was tolerating this violence and injustice in the nation of Judah. Of course, King Josiah had died, and the four remaining kings of Judah before the exile takes place were not really worthy of the role and the position that they held. Now, we're given insight into the inner struggle and turmoil that a person of faith, Habakkuk is certainly a person of faith, he's the prophet we read here. Now, most prophets, like Jeremiah, you're reading the words that God has given him to tell the people. And there certainly are passages where Jeremiah is in discussion with the Lord. He's in prayer. There comes a point when he wishes he'd never been born, and the Lord speaks to him. Well, now we've got much more of an insight into the struggle that Habakkuk is facing here, a struggle and turmoil that this person of faith is going through as they seek to make sense of events around them. Now, Habakkuk, we mentioned, has two points. How long would God seemingly do nothing to deal with the increasing breakdown of daily life, the violence and the injustice? And why as well? Why? We noticed in verse 3, why was there no intervention? And the reply came as a surprise and even as a shock, as we noticed in verses 5 to 11. God told the prophet he had already was at work and was about to send a mighty army from Babylon. It was on its way. And the violence in Judah would be dealt with and the injustice resolved with further violence and further injustice. And it was like that thought then, perhaps, of ourselves with more than a toothache, perhaps, rampant pain, knowing perhaps that a visit to the dentist might initially be more of a painful experience than what we were going through. And so the cure of the Babylonian invasion seemed to Habakkuk at least worse than the illness of Judah's sin. And yet vengeance now would come from outside of Judah. So now we move on in verse 12 to Habakkuk's second complaint. In one sense, it's a follow-on. This is a dialogue between the Lord and Habakkuk, and we are given the privilege to have insight into what was said. Now, verse 12, again, we have a change of speaker. The speaker now is back to the prophet Habakkuk again. And he has further questions. If you look in this section, I've counted four questions in this section. The first one in verse 12 is what we call a rhetorical question. By that we mean it's more making a point, dramatic way of making a point rather than looking for an answer. Habakkuk already knows the answer, and he knows the Lord knows the answer. So he's not asking in the sense of inquiring because he doesn't know. But the other three questions that come out, there are two in verse 13 and one in verse 17, the last verse of this chapter, they're expressing certainly deep concern about how all of this can happen, and certainly the way, the mode, the manner in which it is to take place. So let's have a look at these four questions together. The first, as we said, is a rhetorical question. It expects a positive answer. Habakkuk knows. He says, O Lord, are you not from everlasting? Well, Habakkuk is basically saying, Lord, you are from everlasting. No question about it. He knows that the Lord has always been. It's a fundamental belief about the God who has always been and always will be. The God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, God of Jacob, the God of Moses. This is one of the many what we call attributes, characteristics, qualities that we can speak of that are true of God revealed in Scripture. Here then we see immediately the way that Habakkuk engages in dialogue with the Lord. He starts with something that he knows to be true. And as we come to prayer, and when we have the problems and the difficulties, the conundrums of life, the dark providences, the twists in the road, and we're trying to make sense of it all, it's important, like Habakkuk, to start with something you know about God. A firm footing then, a sure place, a standing ground upon which then you can possibly, if it's enabled to do, to step forward in your discussion and in your concern. And what we notice, he expresses his confidence in the being of God. Certainly, he does have questions over the execution of God's plan and purpose, what's going to happen to these people when he comes to speak to them. But we also notice that there's a second quality here. There's the quality or attribute of holiness. We also see mention of another attribute, my Holy One. Now, this can refer to God's otherness. He is unlike anyone or anything else. He is unique. So there's certainly that element of holiness, other than, no one like him. But also as well, it points to a quality that is without wrong, a nature that is without wrong, without evil, and cannot countenance it. And it's upon these two qualities then, God's everlastingness and also his holiness, that Habakkuk says at the end of verse 12, we will not die. What does he mean by that? Well, he knows that the Lord, and the Lord there is Jehovah, the God of the covenant, who spoke first to Moses about the bringing of the children of Israel out of Egypt, the God of the children of Israel. He then is the God, the Lord of his people. He's eternal and he's holy. And so Habakkuk realizes and he says that it's therefore impossible for the people ultimately to perish, to be annihilated, to be destroyed, to be wiped off the map, as many of the countries that the Babylonians were invading and overrunning, that was happening to them. Once they were taken into exile, once their granaries were robbed and everything was removed, temples were smashed, there was no coming back. The people as a nation, that group, that cultural group, finished completely. And so Habakkuk is basing this thought that, Lord, you are everlasting, you are the Holy One, you are my Holy One, you are my God. There's this personal relationship between God and his people, and therefore we will not die. So although we will have to go through this experience of the Lord dealing and correcting his people because of the injustice and the violence, there's that ultimate thought that it will not be final. It will not be absolute destruction. And it's upon those two qualities that Habakkuk steps forward then. And this is developed then in the remaining statement in verse 12, where he speaks of him as the Lord. We mentioned that word Lord is Jehovah, Yahweh, the God of covenant. But also he describes him, O Lord, you have appointed them to execute judgment. O Rock, you have ordained them to punish. Now, there is this way in Hebrew literature to make a statement and then to follow it immediately after by a similar statement, making the same point, but putting it using different words. In one sense, it brings emphasis. So what you have in the last part of verse 12, O Lord, O Rock, is a reference to the living God. And so it's this thought of him being everlasting. It's the thought of him being holy, unique, and not countenancing sin and evil. He is the Lord, the God of covenant with his people. But he's also, you notice, described as the rock, the unchanging, the immutable one. So we speak of God being immutable, without impossible for him to change, either for the worse or for the better. And that's an ancient title found way back in the book of Deuteronomy. It's part of what's called Moses' song as he blesses the children of Israel before his death and their entry into the promised land. The Song of Moses, Deuteronomy 32, verse 4. He is the rock. His works are perfect and all his ways are just. It's the words of a chorus that we have in the past sung in the fellowship. Also as well, David, the psalmist, spoke of it. Psalm 18, long psalm. The Lord is my rock. He is my fortress and my deliverer. The Lord God is my rock in whom I take refuge. So Habakkuk now then is speaking of the Lord as one then who appoints. He's one who has ordained. And what we're reading into this is that Habakkuk is not a man of weak faith, but he is a man of faith who is perplexed and troubled. And if you're a believer tonight and there are things in your personal life, in your family life, in the circumstances of the church you attend or the community in which we live, and there are things that perplex you and trouble you, you have the questions, how long and why? Well, you can stand here with Habakkuk and realize that Habakkuk is not described as a man of weak faith. He's a man of faith who's perplexed. But he's seeking to understand the Lord's plan. And I'm sure as we, as his children, we desire to know what is the Father's will? What is he accomplishing? So that we can get behind that. We can bring our lives in line with that. He knows things have to be dealt with. That was part and parcel of the first concern that he brought to the Lord in prayer in chapter 1 here in verses 1 to 4. He knows it's got to be dealt with. Indeed, he was praying to the Lord, asking him why he wasn't dealing with it. And he can now see that the Lord has, these are the two verbs, appointed and ordained. He's ordained and appointed means to accomplish this. And the verb punish here means to settle a dispute, to discipline, to bring back by a certain means or method. And the problem then for Habakkuk is that the one who is holy, the one who is everlasting, the one who is the God of covenant, Yahweh, the one who is the rock, that he should use as an instrument a people who are seemingly more wicked than those who are to be corrected. That the means seem more of a problem than the problem itself. And that's the argument then of verse 13, which we move into now. He speaks on the basis, again, of what he knows. Look how verse 13 begins. Your eyes are too pure to look on evil. You cannot tolerate wrong. It's confirmed from Psalm 34, verse 16. The face of the Lord is against those who do evil. And because the Lord is omniscient, that is all-knowing and all-seeing, of course, in one sense, the Lord does see all evil. Nothing is hid from him. No curtain can be pulled, no door can be locked that prevents the Lord from seeing what is done. But this phrase that comes here in terms of you cannot look on evil is not that he's not aware of it or that he does not see it and observe it in that sense, but this look on is that this evil is not condoned. This evil, as we read in the next part of the verse, is not tolerated. He cannot go along with it. He does not put up with it. And that's the thought that came out in Habakkuk at the beginning, in chapter 1 and verse 3. He said, "Why do you tolerate wrong? It seems to be against your very nature, Lord." And Habakkuk was right. Now, there was emphasis on purity. We've seen that in the fact that he speaks of the Lord as the Holy One. And in all the dealings with regards to the tabernacle in the Old Testament days of wilderness, and also as well with regards to what was happening in the temple in Jerusalem, we notice this, that there was emphasis on purity. The gold that was used in the temple, it had to be pure gold, unalloyed gold, top quality gold. The priests were to be clothed in pure garments. These are references we'd find in Exodus 25 with regards to the gold in verse 11 of that chapter and the priests' garments in verse 2. And this then brings this thought then that everything is to be pure, every instrument, every object is to be purified and to be clean and to be whole. This is causing a problem with Habakkuk, you see. Now, are you able to see what he's struggling with? This brings us to the puzzling questions. He's asking the Lord, "Why are you seemingly tolerating the treacherous? And why are you silent while those who seem to be more righteous than the Babylonians are going to be swallowed up, being eaten up, being devoured?" And so we can see that Habakkuk's having this difficulty. The Lord is holy. All the instruments and all the individuals, the necessary sacrifices before a priest could begin to sacrifice on behalf of others, the high priest himself, it was all to be pure and clean and holy and without evil and without sin. Well, then why, Lord, in correcting your people, are you using an instrument, a people that are unclean and unholy, unrighteous? Well, in one sense, we know that there is none righteous. This is what the Psalms tell us. There's a quotation in Romans chapter 3 that quotes the Psalms. There is none that seek God. There is none that do righteous deeds. And Romans 3 verse 23 does tell us that each and every one of us have sinned. We've all sinned and come short of the glory of God. And in that sense, none are righteous. But why use those who are unrighteous to correct those who seemingly are less unrighteous? They're still unrighteous because of the wickedness and because of the violence and because of the injustice that Habakkuk knows that's happening in Judah itself. But how then can the Lord use other unrighteous things to bring to pass his dealings with his people? And Habakkuk now sets out the problem in much more detail. He's outlined it. He's sort of laid the foundation in verses 12 and 13. He now goes into some detail, and we'll quickly look through this, and we'll notice he's aware, and this dates the book then to the end, the closing years of the 7th century. So we're talking about 612, 606 BC. We know that eventually Judah is to go into exile in 586 BC. That's the what we call the early years of the 6th century. But this is now at the end of the 7th century BC, 606, and we're working down to 600, 599, 587, where 586 when the actual exile takes place. So we're looking at a period of maybe 20 years before the destruction does ultimately take place. But he's aware, you see, Habakkuk is already aware of how the Babylonians operate. He knows. He knows how they conduct themselves in warfare. So that's why we can date the book to that period of time. how they treat their captives. There's no human rights organisation. There's no Red Cross that come in and look at a camp and see how people are being treated. None of this. And he's struggling to understand how the Lord could in any way use them in the process of correcting and disciplining and chastening his own people. Although they need, he acknowledges, they need to be dealt with. And this is what we find. In verse 14, the Babylonians are pictured as a group of fishermen, so to speak. What are they doing? We read here, you have made men like fish of the sea. This is a description. Man was made above the animals. But it's almost as if these nations, as well as Judah now, are going to be treated as a shoal of fish, just gathered up in a net and taken captive. They're trawling the seabed. They're netting the populations of the nations they invade, as would a band of fishermen, a shoal of fish. And we read there in verse 15 that the wicked foe pulls them all up with hooks and he catches them in his net. Now, there is a reference in history to the Assyrian Empire, the one that preceded the Babylonian Empire, of putting hooks, not so much through the nose, but putting hooks through the lower lips of captives and then having them in a chain, so to speak, on a chain, and maybe a few of them on a chain. And so a little tug would cause pain. And so it produced a compliance. It made you docile. It was no good you trying to rebel, no good you trying to fight it. Once that was in, you had to give in. Because the anguish and the pain that you would suffer because of it. And on top of that, maybe the beating and maybe put to death. So it was a way of putting a hook through a lower lip of captives to make them comply and to be docile and then to transport them away from their homeland. And the whole idea of that was, you see, if you transport them away from their homeland, that idea that we're still living in our homeland and we must rise up in force and rebel against the enemy and recapture the land in which we live, well, that was out of the question. The first struggle they'd have would be to get themselves free and then to try and make their way back to the homeland and then perhaps to try and regain the land. So it was a means of bringing docility, bringing submission in those whom they captured. And the Babylonians, as we mentioned, this was something the Assyrians said, this was something the Babylonians also picked up from the Assyrians and continued to do. Now you'll notice reference also here to in verse 16 to a net and to a dragnet. There's also reference to it in verse 15. He catches them in his net, he gathers them up in his dragnet, and so he rejoices and is glad. The net was smaller, the dragnet was a little larger, but both we notice are used, and no one seemingly is able to escape. No one's able to evade capture. It's almost as if they throw the net over a whole town or a city or an area and everyone is gathered in and nothing is missed. And verse 16 is, in one sense, a way now of describing how the Babylonians thought of themselves and how they venerated these nets, call them, in one sense, their weapons. They venerated and exalted and, in one sense, put on a pedestal their military strength. And this goes back to something that Habakkuk had already said in verse 11. Then they sweep past like the wind and go on, guilty men whose own strength is their God, their own military power. And they in one sense, venerated it and they spoke of it, right is might. Well, why? Because, well, they benefited from it. We read they enjoy it. They live in luxury. They enjoy the choicest food. For by his net he lives in luxury. And so he rejoices, verse 15 tells us, and he is glad. It was bringing prosperity. It was empire building, extending. Now we know something of this. Those of us who were brought up in the schools where we had the large map, it was a bit out of date by the time I was in school, but it was still being thought about very highly. The pink map, was it a third of the world was pink, showing the extent of the empire. But we know, And some of the consequences of that now, we're struggling now to those people that perhaps we took advantage of. We took some of their resources, and then we gave them a little passport to tell them that they could be part of this great empire. And now we're finding when they've come to perhaps to this country, the whole Windrush situation, as we've been following it, it's almost as if there hasn't been an honouring of it. But there's this thought, the empire is extending. Here's the Babylonian Empire. It's extending, it's increasing. They want for nothing. It brings them prosperity. There's luxury here, as they loot the bounty and the booty from these various towns and cities, and they rob the stores of food, the granaries as well, or anything else that might have been set aside in some of these cities with the kings, and as well as the normal ordinary people with their grain. It was all open to these Babylonians as they rampaged through these cities. And it's this thought as well of what's called the excessive grasping and covetous attitude of the Babylonians, old-fashioned word of the rapaciousness of this nation. That brings us to this third question. As we've said, there are four. The first was rhetorical, but we picked up two questions in verse 13. Why do you tolerate the treacherous? Why do you tolerate, and why do you allow those who are more unrighteous to swallow up those who are more righteous than themselves? And then verse 17, is he to keep on emptying his net, destroying nations without mercy? Here's this last question that's causing Habakkuk a problem. We might think perhaps now of the agreements between countries that exist on fishing quotas. This was something that previously was agreed, although not always accepted in the European Union, between France and Spain and Britain. But certainly we've been picking up recently difficulties in St Heliers in Jersey. There's a whole discussion now about licenses and fishing quotas. And we understand what it's about. It's to prevent the devastation of the fish stock. Now, what we have here is Habakkuk saying, Lord, these people that you're going to allow to come into our country to deal with the violence and the injustice, which I pray that you would, they're going to keep on emptying their nets. There's going to be no quota. There's going to be no pausing and stopping and saying, well, that's enough. It's like the other picture in Isaiah. They're going to come in and they're even going to take every grape off the vine. They're not just going to take the best and leave a bit. No, they're going to completely decimate it. It's a similar picture that comes out in the book of Joel. Joel takes a different way to illustrate this, of the enemy coming in, and he speaks of them coming as locusts, and a swarm comes in, and various types of locusts at various stages of development, and they come in and they eat everything. They eat the trees, the grass, the fruit, everything. It's decimated. And this is the concern that Habakkuk has here. He says, if this were to happen, Lord, if this is your plan, if you've ordained this, well, they're going to keep on emptying his net. He'll carry on. He'll be there. He'll unload. He'll be back. There'll be no stopping. Destroying nations. And it's in the plural there. There is this thought, he's aware of his own, but he's aware of the other nations as well. It's happening to them. And they're doing it, notice, without mercy. And that's the problem that Habakkuk has. The Lord who is everlasting, the Lord who is holy, the Lord who is unchanging, the Lord who is the God of the covenant, he also knows him to be merciful. But those who are the instruments in the Lord's hands, who've been appointed and ordained, he says they are without mercy. And he's struggling. How can a merciful God use these people who are without mercy to correct his own chosen people? And we struggle sometimes with what comes into our lives, some difficulties. Sometimes it's from within, sometimes it's from without. Habakkuk has ordered his concern carefully. He has worked on the basis of what he knows. What he knows of the Lord's character and of the Lord's dealings. And he's lodged his concern. You might even say he's lodged his objection here to what the Lord has said he will do. And where do we leave him? Well, we leave him standing in verse 1 of chapter 2, remembering this. We put this division here, there are those who've done it, but initially now this was one document, one prophecy, there's no division. We leave him here then in the first verse of chapter 2, standing on watch. As a prophet, he's the watchman, he's standing on duty as a sentry, he's alert, he's waiting for the Lord to reply. He knows that he's been, in one sense, audacious. He knows he's been bold. He knows he's been daring to speak to the Lord like this. And he's waiting really now for a rebuke. And when you read that last part of verse 1, and what answer I will give to this complaint, he's already in his mind beginning to think of an answer that he will give to the rebuke that he feels God will give him. But what we do observe, and we'll close on this point, we observe three good qualities here in Habakkuk. And as we've noticed the characteristics of God's nature, as Habakkuk has outlined it, look at these three qualities, and I commend them to you. You've got to say about Habakkuk, in his prayer with God, he's been honest, hasn't he? He's expressed the issue that is troubling him. Now, some of us, we've got problems, we've got questions, and we feel it would be very unwise of us to question any of God's ways. In one sense, we are wise to think like that, because God is good and he does good. But when we're thinking that in our heads, but not feeling that in our hearts, we're not being honest, are we? And so Habakkuk is a man who is struggling with the difficulties, but he's honest in his praying. And I know, and I am sure, that whatever words are spoken, if they come from an honest heart, if it's an honest inquiry, if it's an honest concern, an honest objection, an honest sense of puzzlement and pondering, well then we will notice. When you begin to see the Lord answering in verse 2 of chapter 2, it doesn't begin with the Lord rebuking him. The Lord goes into the response. So it's always right and good to be honest. Second thing, notice this. He shows humility. He's now standing. He's alert. He's ready. He's waiting for an answer. He's ready to receive a rebuke. He's humble. He's acknowledging that he knows who the Lord is. He's questioning some of the modes and the manner in which this is going to happen. But he's humble. He's saying, Lord, I cannot understand. I do not know. I cannot make sense of it. But I know who you are. You are the Lord God, the everlasting God, the holy God. But I also note as well with you that he's hopeful. He's hopeful. He's not a man of no faith. But he is a man of faith who's perplexed and he's puzzled. Now, with all the difficulties then, let's close on this point. With all the difficulties that we may have and we may be facing in our own lives this evening, in the context of our family circumstances, the context of national life, I'm certainly feeling a sense of division. I don't know about you. As a result of these elections, there's certainly an emphasis upon not getting on, not seeing things the same. International relations as well, this whole issue of East and West. Let us always continue dialogue. That is praying to God about these things. And let's do so with honesty. Let's not pretend. Let's do so with humility. And let's do it with hope in our hearts, based on what we already know of his great nature. And that's where we leave the prophet then. And it's another of the commentators that I read who said, we leave Habakkuk at this point. Can he trust God even when he couldn't trace God's love and compassion in this? Could he still trust him? What about you? Can you trust God tonight, though you cannot trace him? Though you're in the dark, do you still know that God is light? And those who walk with God, though in the darkness, they are walking as if they are in the light, for he cares for them, and underneath us are the everlasting arms. I pray that you'd experience that this week as you go through the difficulties and problems in the various circles of your life's experience. May God bless his word to our hearts.